This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to this special Place to Be Network presentation. I am Scott Criscolo, co-host of the Place to Be podcast, host of Place to Be Nation's main event, and co-host of Place to Be Nation's Extra Point. Back in the wintertime, Place to Be Nation podcast network, we did a special in commemoration of what is the 30th WrestleMania. We did a special WrestleMania Rewind series where we took, I think, what was it, six WrestleManias from varying eras of the pay-per-view era, going back to 1985, and broke it down, not match by match, not like my PIC, Justin Rosero, and I do on our Vintage Vaults, but from a different perspective. The backstory of the climate of the company in WWE at the time, and the characters and the angles and things like that, and talking about the show as a whole from a different perspective, not just go match by match. And it was very successful, and we appreciate everybody who listened because we got a lot of hits on all of those shows. I did WrestleMania 4, and I might be the only time anybody will ever want Parv and I on the same show because I think that show went like 4.5 hours, just like WrestleMania 4 did. But anyway, it was so successful, we decided, since we are in the summertime and this is the second biggest show of the year, that we're going to do the same thing for SummerSlam, and which is actually my personal favorite pay-per-view of the year. Because that was the one I used to buy as a kid. I used to host SummerSlam, so I've always had a soft spot for it. And we're doing the same thing. So if you look at the Place to Be podcast network, you'll see a myriad of specials on specific SummerSlams. The one that we're doing here tonight is a kind of a different one, one you may not think of, but in my opinion, and I'm looking forward to the rest of our panel tonight, that this is one that's a little more important than people think because it's a huge year in the history of the business. And we'll delve into that tonight. But let me bring in my partners tonight. First off, one of my favorite people. He is the producer slash co-host of the Steve Corino Show on the Place to Be Nation Network. He is now your official Raw recap writer. and generally all around nice guy, Mr. Dan McGinn. And he's my Legends House co-writer as well. Have you ever had a resume this big? You should be pretty happy.
Yeah, no, it's funny. The side project is a lot more lucrative as far as experience goes than my actual 9-to-5. But
I think that's everybody's.
I could explain later and gush over this, but if not for the third member of our panel, I'm not even sure any of this would be possible. But we can get into that down the road. But yes, Scott, I mean, we've been, you know, you and I have been kind of chatting on and off since the fall and when I joined the site. And I just said, it's funny, I always wanted to do a show alongside with you. I just was wondering what that venue would be. And of all the guesses that I had, this particular SummerSlam wasn't going to be the one I was thinking, but I'm glad to be here just the same.
That's why I do what I do. But Dan, it's a pleasure. On the other side of the experience coin, we have our other guest, who is an icon here at Place to Be Nation. Not only is he a great contributor, he is also the purveyor of one of my favorite websites ever, thehistoryofwwe.com. He's got 4 books, all better than Mick Foley. And I think of him every day because I usually at work watch or listen to an NWA/WCW pay-per-view, and I usually have questions for him. Tonight I actually had a chance to ask him one. Ladies and gentlemen, the great Graham Cawthon.
You think about me every day?
Of course I do. I'm comfortable in saying that. And if people have other ways of thinking, then that's their problem. I think about you because I said today, you know, I got to ask Graham about this Bruno Sammartino thing at Halloween Havoc. But if others want to think other things, well, then they're the depraved ones, not me. See how like, I spun that?
I am the depraved one.
See, yeah, that's how I spun that. Graham, you're the best. And thank you for coming on.
Because, well, thank you.
Because this is an interesting one, guys. And we've had, I believe, some of the others, 89, which is my second favorite SummerSlam of all time, behind 98. 92, which is, I believe, my PIC, Mr. Azzaro's favorite SummerSlam, I believe.
Well, that's the best show of all time.
So. 97. Right, popular ones. But I wanted to do one that nobody really talks about that much, but it's fascinating because of the period in history. Tonight, guys, we are going to do SummerSlam 2005. And you think to yourself, the hell happened at SummerSlam 2005? That's what we're going to talk about tonight. Before we dive into the show itself, let's talk about the timeline of WWE history. It's broken into pieces. The pay-per-view era, for me, the modern-day era of WWE started at WrestleMania 1. So for me, it's 1985. Now, that doesn't discount everything before that, because everything before that's very cool. But 1985, when the pay-per-view era began, is where I feel the timeline of WWE history really begins, with WrestleMania 1. Now, from 85 to 93 is what we call the Federation years. The Hogans, the Savage, Warrior, that kind of group. Then from 93 to 97 is the transition year, or the new generation, which had its goods and a lot of its bads. Then, of course, from 98 to 2002, or 2003, if you want to stretch it, was, of course, the Attitude Era. Then 2003 to 2005 was kind of like a transition again. But if you really look at the timeline, 2005 is probably one of the most important years in WWE history because of 2 major characters that came from that year that have shaped the landscape since. One, of course, being John Cena, the other being Batista, because both of them won their first world championships that April at WrestleMania 21. And that is where what many consider the John Cena era began. So this is the first, not only is this main event huge, and we'll talk about that, but this is also the first John Cena SummerSlam, in which he is a main cog, as well as Batista. So I think that's why I find this SummerSlam so fascinating, because this is one that in the pantheon of SummerSlams is a lot more important than people think, not just because of the main event that we'll talk about, but of the other matches, the 2 title matches and a few others as well. Graham, through that era of 2003 to 2005, when we were in that in-between phase, a lot of people consider WrestleMania 19 the end of the Attitude Era. The end of Austin, the end of Rock, you know, that run. And Triple H became like the transition guy into that era. But then we had Brock and we had other, you know, Booker and we had some other main event guys. But there was not a face of the company in those couple of years. We had faces for a few months, like Chris Benoit and that kind of thing. At that time, what were your thoughts on the company? Did you feel there was a bright future? Was it cloudy? What were your thoughts as a fan in those couple of years after the Attitude Era ended?
I think in 03, I really enjoyed SmackDown, and I really thought Raw was lacking talent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I thought SmackDown, you had Brock, you had Eddie, you had Benoit, you had Angle, and then Raw was just the Triple H show and whoever else he was working with that month, whether it be Kevin Nash or whatever. I think in 04, things kind of leveled out a little bit. And, you know, 04, that was the first time I got to go to Mania. That was the first time I got to go to Madison Square Garden, and a lot of that was because of that buildup. I thought the Royal Rumble was really strong. I thought Mania was really strong. I thought a lot of the shows... Both shows was heavier on the wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they introduced a lot of new talent during that time that was captivating both as the character and in ring. And I'll just throw a name out, Eugene, as an example of that.
Mm-hmm.
05 was very, you know, you could tell that they were putting a lot of stock into creating new top talent, that being Cena and Batista. And I think this show is an example of, yes, that's our future, but we're not quite ready to make that our present.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why you have a marquee match like Michaels and Hogan,
mm-hmm,
as what the show is built around and what the show is sold on. And then you've got your two respective world champions that are not closing the show. And moreover than that, they're not even really in matches where their title is threatened. They're clearly in matches in which they are to be highlighted as the future, but they're not the future. They are the future, but they're not the present.
Right. Now, Dan, when did you actually become... I mean, I know you've been a fan for a while, but when did your fandom really start? Before this, right? Attitude Era?
Oh yeah, much earlier than that.
I figured that's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I had come back from an auto show, a car show, and it was like on a Sunday, and there was nothing really on television. And for some reason, the angle that got my attention was Rugged Ronnie Garvin dressed as a referee, because he had recently been fired and he was now a referee, and he, you know, and Greg Valentine, and for some reason that drew my attention in, and I was like, I need to watch this more, you know, and then I was,
right,
you know, out and searching for it. But it was probably the first pay-per-view, and I wrote about this a long time ago, and I was very new to the site, about my first pay-per-view experience was Survivor Series back in 1989. And I remember just taping it when it wasn't allowed, of course, and then just rewatching it, and even I'd have a new friend over, and I'd watch that tape, And it was just so crazy, because it was, you know, I was, you know, Hulkamania all the way. I was, you know, Ultimate Warrior. I was painting my face. You know, there was all kinds of, and there were a lot of kids in the neighborhood, and we'd all watch it. And so it was really that, like you were talking about earlier, the Federation years, the golden era that, you know, really sparked my attention when I was just a little one. And then eventually it just sort of spiraled from there.
Mm. Yeah, I became a fan a few years before that, but that summer, I was that way. The way you were with Survivor Series 89 is what I was with SummerSlam 89. Same thing. I taped it. I didn't think it was illegal to tape it, but I never really paid attention to rules like that back then. And I played the hell out of it forever. That's why it's one of my favorites, till the one in 98 at the Garden. Definitely, though, the Attitude Era, obviously the big moneymaker, saved the company. But by, like, I would say by the middle of 02 is when you really started to see that wind down. Austin, of course, left. Rock was taking his hiatuses, making his movies. Hogan came back, but you knew that was temporary. Obviously, the two big moments in 02, besides the NWO, which that fizzled quick, was the birth of Brock Lesnar and the return of Shawn Michaels, which, if you listen to our vaults that Justin and I did recently, the tail end of 2002... Him and I were both very skeptical that he was sticking around. Even when he won the world title at the Survivor Series that year at the Garden, we were thinking, well, all right, this is just kind of, you know, his last, though, his Garden moment, and then he'll drop it, you know, to Triple H or whoever, and then leave. And obviously he didn't. He lasted for another 8 years of great in-ring deliciousness. Now, we get into 05, and obviously in 04, the face of the company was Randy Orton. That was the guy they were really banking on. I mean, he had that great match with Edge at Vengeance in Hartford. Very rare Connecticut pay-per-view I didn't go to. Then, of course, he beat Chris Benoit at SummerSlam to win the world title, and then the aborted face turn and Triple H winning it back and all that kind of stuff. Graham, in 2004, did you see a future with Randy Orton at that point? Or were you skeptical too?
No. As soon as, and it broke my heart because, like I said, I went to Mania to see Benoit get the belt. And then for Orton to win it, to me, that told the story of this is the guy. You know, they just built WrestleMania around this guy, but this is the new young guy that they want to build a company around. And that was cemented the next night when Evolution turned on him. So, yeah, I kind of figured that they're going to, you know, build everything around him for this next several months. And then, of course, it's Survivor Series. He's the sole survivor. So I just figured it Mania would be him and Triple H.
What do you think, Dan? Were you enamored with Orton in 2004? Was he a guy that you thought could be latched on to? Because remember, also at the same time as Orton elevating was Edge elevating. And I think overall, I think Edge was a little more popular with the fans because they loved him throughout the Attitude Era. And, of course, the tag renaissance in 2000. Was Edge in a funny spot, Dan, you think? Or was there enough room for both of them? Because really, at the time, Cena was still just mid-card fodder and Batista was just the Arn Anderson of Evolution. Did you think that there was enough room at that time for both Edge and Orton?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of people were kind of like me, or at least I think that there was definitely some room to kind of, you know, change it up and get some new blood in there. I think that Edge might have been a little bit maybe on the safer side because he had been around and had already really established a fan base where, you know, Orton was like, whoa, all of a sudden, who is this guy? And you know, he's here. So I think there was definitely a possibility in trying to rewatch some of this from early 05. You really started to see that people did get a little like sick and tired of the whole Orton thing. And there was probably a need for a change, but, I was always a big Edge guy myself. So I was always kind of like, all right, this is it. This is when he's going to break through that ceiling, you know, and then he's going to run with it. And it, they're finally going to pull the trigger. And, you know, as you'll see over time, you know, those results were probably, you know, spotty and shaky at best, but you know, I was always a believer that, that Edge would be the guy.
Now, another guy, of course, I just mentioned, but was still on the back burner was Batista. At SummerSlam 04, he was in that three-way with Edge and Chris Jericho over the Intercontinental title, but nobody really thought anything of it. It was probably by the end of 04 that people really saw Batista as maybe the more shining guy in Evolution. Graham, did Orton even have a chance? Do you think he was... you know, wrong place, wrong time. Do you think that that the whole situation with Evolution and then Triple H winning it back a month later, was he derailed at that point, or did he still have a chance by the time 2005 started?
Oh, I don't think he was derailed at all. When I saw that the title had changed hands, I just figured, okay, well, what they're doing is they screwed over Orton. Kind of like what we saw with Daniel Bryan here a few months ago. You screw him over, you get the crowd behind him, he wins the Royal Rumble and he gets his title shot and he wins the title back. I mean, that's like the full, it's almost like the what the Lex Luger thing was originally intended to be. And I thought that was the course that they were setting. I think, and really when you said in the wintertime, you know, Orton won the Survivor Series and I believe that closed the show. So I figured that was, that's pretty much the direction that they're going. Now I say that not being a huge Orton fan at the time, I just figured, okay, well, that clarifies what I thought was going to be the case anyway. And so when you get to the Royal Rumble, I'm sorry, when you get to New Year's Revolution, it pretty much ends the way I anticipated. Triple H has the belt. And then they pull the trigger on Triple H Orton as a singles at the Rumble. And that was kind of surprising. And I didn't anticipate that because I figured they, you know, kind of want to draw that one out and make Mania more special. So I didn't really understand why they were doing the singles then. And then, of course, at the end of the night, you realize why.
Right. So at some point then, between New Year's Revolution and the Royal Rumble, they realized that Batista was the guy and not Orton.
Oh, I think they realized beforehand, you know, playing in with the finish of New Year's Revolution.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Now, we'll get back to those guys in a minute. John Cena, of course, his first big WrestleMania moment was 2004 at WrestleMania 20. Graham, you were there. I was there. Justin was there. When he opened the show with his U.S. title win over The Big Show. And he had a pretty good 2004. Nothing earth-shattering. I mean, he was, you know, he was obviously in the mid-card behind JBL and Undertaker and all that dreg. He had that good feud with Booker that was a lot of fun. And, right, was it Booker? Yeah, it was Booker. And, you know, he kind of coasted through the end of 04. When did you see, Dan, by the beginning, heading into 05, that Cena was the other guy that they were focusing on? Did you notice it in 04 that this was a guy that they could that they were elevating, or were you still thinking? Because I really didn't think it until, you know, the Rumble that Cena was the guy. I felt he was under the radar most of 2004. What do you think?
I think so, too. I think there was always the potential. Obviously, we are going to use that word quite a bit. I think it was a unique character, particularly with all the retro jerseys and everything. And, you know, and I think a lot of people did, you know, some people don't want to admit it now, but the Thugonomics thing had its group of fans. But I kind of agree with you about the Rumble. If you rewatch that Rumble, just the amazing like pop that happens when his old music hits and he comes out to the ring, it's just like, whoa. Like, if you were somebody that was like, I don't really watch the mid-2000s at all, and I'm gonna watch a show, and you hear his music hit and he's about to come out, you're gonna say, wow, this guy, that's blue chip right there. That is like, that is your marketable, that's your franchise. And of course it ended up happening. But if you were watching at the time, like leading up to it, you might not necessarily think so. Now looking back in hindsight, it's like, oh, of course they had gold and they, you know, and they did something with it. But yeah, at the Rumble, I saw it and he was all the way there to the end. And yeah, it was kind of a crazy finish, but I could legitimately say, you know, this guy could win this. This guy could absolutely win this. And this is the torch being passed. It turns out I was one off, but you know what I'm saying? It was amazing to me watching that again now, many, many years later, mm-hmm. saying, geez, you know, that you never hear that sort of pop for him now. It's amazing it even happened. It's almost hard to believe it was happening at that time.
Mm. What were your thoughts on Cena, Graham, by the end of 04, going into 05?
That he was unstoppable.
Yeah.
I think throughout 2004, he was, you know, he maybe he wasn't closing the shows on SmackDown. No, I think he probably was closing the shows on SmackDown.
He might have been, yeah.
He wasn't closing the pay-per-views. But he was like Warrior in 89. And I was just kind of waiting for him to get his Warrior Hogan moment. And I mean, there was he was so well protected. He was so over with the crowd. And it was almost to the point where in late 03, you know, I think what the 2000, going back a year, the 2004 Royal Rumble in retrospect, yeah. Yeah, it was so obvious who was going to win. But I think at the time, there was about a half a dozen people that you could have said he has a strong shot. Mm-hmm. And Cena was even the poster child for that pay-per-view.
Yes, he was.
And I know people that, yep. And I know people that were picking him to win the Rumble in 04. So I kind of saw 04 as his let me work on my strengths, because I'm not quite main event, but give me a year. Mm. So by late 04, you know, he drops the U.S. belt to Carlito. Yeah, it was Carlito. And then he comes back and he like kills Jesus.
Yes.
And it's just
jaw-jacks him.
Like that was very much like an old Ultimate Warrior Bobby Heenan kind of situation.
Yeah,
where the crowd,
right.
You know, he just kills him. And the crowd eats it up because they don't want to see a match. They just want to see him kill him. Mm-hmm. And so I thought by the Rumble, he's the guy that they're going to build WrestleMania around. And he just wasn't the guy.
Right. Now, of course, we get to WrestleMania. Now, Batista already had his title shot earned at the Rumble. And then, of course, there was the awesome build to what show he'd go to. And that led to, even though it was against my guy, one of my favorite Raw moments of all time, the original thumbs down, and then he power bombs Triple H through the desk or the table, which I always thought was pretty damn cool. Meanwhile, Cena, they do that number one contenders tournament. He beats Kurt Angle at No Way Out to get that shot at JBL. He's still U.S. champion because then he obviously have to get the belt off him, so he loses it on SmackDown to the O-ring himself there, Orlando Jordan. At WrestleMania, which I don't think was a terrible show, we were another feud that culminates at SummerSlam began, and that was between Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And, of course, Cena wins the title, beats JBL in a kind of nondescript, like, nine-minute match that not many people totally remember in terms of the match itself. And then, of course, the main event, Batista ends the reign of the game, beats Triple H, and wins the World Heavyweight title. Two questions for you, Dan. Did you like that show? And should Cena have won the belt that night, considering Batista later on? Do you think it would have been fine just to have a DQ schmoz and then have that great I quit at Judgment Day? Or what were your thoughts on that?
I see what they were going with. I really enjoyed the first maybe two-thirds of that show. I felt like almost every match was like a main event. It was a special occasion. It was something that I could just throw in and enjoy. You had the Money in the Bank. You had Eddie, you know, we didn't realize it at the time, but some of the last matches we'd see with Eddie and Ray, and just, it was just a fun show, just going down top to bottom. And then it did kind of have that letdown factor, I thought, with the Cena and JBL, because the problem was, is I see what they were going with. They wanted to show that, hey, here are two new studs, and here they are winning on the biggest stage. I get that. However, you almost, like you said, you forget that John Cena won that match. It just sort of comes out of nowhere. JBL has this really long, lengthy, historic title reign, and next thing you know, oh my gosh, he just lost, and rather cleanly too. And it was just, and it was a match that you forgot about just as quickly as it happened, because a few minutes later, hey, Batista just won. So looking back on it, I do tend to agree with, I think you and Justin might have talked about this in your written review, is that, you know, could they have pushed it to another month and had a like an epic battle like they did? Yeah, absolutely. But at the time, they didn't want to do it that way. They wanted to have the two major titles change, and you can't really fault them for that. They just might have been able to execute the Cena portion of it a little bit better.
What do you think of that, Graham? Would you have had Cena win that night?
Well, I was thinking, as you guys were talking a few minutes ago, I thought that WrestleMania 21 was very much a, here are our new guys, and we're going to force them down your throats. And what came after that show, whether it be at Judgment Day or at, what was the June show?
June 05. Vengeance.
Yeah, Vengeance.
Well, you had One Night Stand and Vengeance, but
right,
for our purposes, more Vengeance is the more important pay-per-view.
But in May, you had the I Quit, which was Cena kind of proving himself. And then at Vengeance, you had Hell in the Cell, which was Batista kind of proving himself.
Mm-hmm.
And there were WrestleMania rematches. But I think by then, they solidify that they're the guy. I think at WrestleMania, it was, oh, they won a match. But had they really, you know, they won one match. I don't know if going into it, anyone saw them as, you know, that's the poster person of WWE.
Mm-hmm.
I think Cena had more emotional investment with the crowd at that point, because Batista had just turned 6 weeks earlier. Batista may have had a little fan following before him, but he was still a heel.
Right.
So I was really surprised that they closed the show with him, because I didn't care about Batista.
Mm-hmm.
I cared about seeing it to some extent, and then they just kind of give him a 9-minute match that really was anticlimactic, and then he celebrates in the crowd.
Right.
So I thought, you know, Mania was, let's pull the trigger, but let's not really have it mean that much.
Hmm.
They just won a match. But there, I don't think there had been enough backstory or enough wins beforehand for them to be seen as credible in that role.
Right. You know, it's funny because right before Vengeance, there was the draft, and this is where I think they felt they were very vested in Cena, because then they drafted him in Raw, and they ended up pushing Batista to SmackDown after the Triple H feud ended when he beat him in the Hell in a Cell. So I think that's where they realized, all right, Batista had a good run here, but I think we know who the... I think they had made their bed on who they thought the more bankable guy was in terms of marketing, and that was Cena. And I think that's why he went to Raw in the...
Yeah, and I think WrestleMania closed with Batista Triple H because of Triple H.
Oh, yeah.
Not because of Batista.
Right.
And Cena was in the mid-card because of JBL, not because of Cena.
Right. Good point. Yep. I agree. That's a good way to put it. All right. Let's dive into the card, because we're going to break down the not the match, but the feud, because a lot of the feuds that happened and a lot of the match that happened at this SummerSlam go back to WrestleMania, and some of the feuds go beyond WrestleMania. Dan, because you're still the newbie, I want you to break down the Chris Masters Hurricane match on Heat. No, I'm just kidding. I would never do that to you. Unless you know. No, that was the Heat match. Now, the opener of that show is probably one of the funniest things ever. And that was Chris Benoit and Orlando Jordan for the aforementioned United States Championship that Orlando Jordan had won between No Way Out and WrestleMania when they needed to get the belt off Cena. What were your thoughts, Dan, on Benoit at this point? He had a great 04, then lost to Orton, kind of stayed in the main events a little bit, and then in 05 kind of settled back into the mid-card. Did you feel he was ever going to get a shot at the main events again? Or you think they did their token, all right, everybody liked him, we let him win something, and all right, now you've had your fun, we have other things to do. But did you ever think that Benoit may get another main event shot at this point?
I always thought that Benoit was going to be the guy that they always would have in their back pocket. Like, well, if all else fails or someone gets hurt, we always have Benoit. You know, I always kind of looked at him that way after the 04 run. They knew he could go. They knew he could put on good matches. Even if he was the really stiff competition for a new champion to kind of give him a program for a little bit, I always thought that he would be that type of guy. And then, oh, you know what? Hey, let's just give him a push. Let's give him another go with it, because we know he can go. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was kind of tough looking back. You know, wow, what a difference a year makes. You know, and he's like, you know, losing in matches against a guy like Orlando Jordan, you know, granted it was, you know, under some really sketchy circumstances, but mm-hmm. you say to yourself, this guy was champion like 365 days ago. Like, this was like one of our best and favorite moments of 2004. And now all of a sudden he's, you know, sitting here in the early portion of a card and facing a guy that, you know, he has like oodles more talent than, and he's losing. You know, like I just remember watching, you know, thinking, wow, he just lost that match. What's going on here? So when you look back at this opener, and I always think of Orlando Jordan very similar to those of like those heavyweight boxers who don't really face anybody, who just has the belt. It's just sort of like a decoration. But then they'd come up against a guy like Tyson in a tune-up match, and then they get mopped up in like 35 seconds. I think of like guys like Bruce Seldon and Frank Bruno. They look menacing against nobodies, and then all of a sudden they get like the, you know, Iron Mike in the ring, and they just get pummeled. Well, that's how I looked at this match. When, and of course, the end result was very
Frank
similar.
Frank Bruno. Yeah. Look at that, Dan. I thought you were going to say Pinklin Thomas next, or Trevor Burbick.
Right.
Oh, that's great.
But, you know, it's like, when you look at this match, that's what it felt like to me. It's like, all right, here you have a guy that's clearly the class of the bid card that really deserves a little bit more. Let's throw him a bone on a really big show like SummerSlam. Orlando's had the belt, and he's, you know, come hook or by crook, he's keeping this belt all this time. And it was just very fitting to see him lose in such dramatic and spectacular fashion, in record time even. So that's kind of how I looked at it. And Benoit certainly at this point deserved a big win on a major show.
Mm. What were your thoughts on Benoit at this point, Graham?
He was my favorite. I don't want to talk about him anymore.
I know, it's very hard.
Yeah, it is. No, I thought I agree that, you know, if you look at 04 and you look at 05, obviously a huge difference there. And you know who is in that same role right now, and no one can deny it. Of course, also no one can think of it.
Daniel Bryan? No.
Dolph Ziggler.
Dolph Ziggler. Yeah.
Yep.
I think the injury.
He's the
was a part of that too.
Whatever. You can say whatever excuse that you want, but he goes in there every night, makes his opponent look better than his opponent actually is.
Yes, I agree with that.
And, you know, a year and a half ago, he was the main event guy, wins the world title, huge pop, and now he's, you know, being tossed out of the ring by Miz just because he was hiding at ringside the whole match. You know, anyone watching the show could have just said, you know, Dolph, he's obviously hiding at ringside. I mean, have you not seen a battle royal like this before? He's gonna throw you out when you're not looking.
Right.
So, I thought it was phenomenal. A great way to open the show. I think that the booking of that opening match is just a great way to open any big pay-per-view of the scale.
Mm-hmm.
Because the crowd, obviously, behind Benoit, and to put him over to that degree in that short a time period, any kind of title change, guaranteed pop. With such a short match, guaranteed pop. With a crowd favorite, guaranteed pop. It's just a great feel-good to open the show.
Mm. Yeah, it was. I mean, I think they wrestled at the Bash, and I think Benoit won by DQ, or I don't think he lost.
No, Jordan won.
He did win that match. Okay.
Yeah.
He did win that match.
The old exposed turnbuckle did him in.
Ah, the ring. Oh, Jordan used the O ring to win that match, and then of course, and then Benoit pretty much puts him in the crossface, and that pretty much was the end of that. So Chris Benoit is your U.S. champion here, and Orlando Jordan kind of vanishes into the nothingness because the whole whatever the cabinet of JBL was pretty much gone at that point.
Do you remember the rematches they had after this on television?
Yeah, they were all pretty much the same.
He squashed. It was great because in every match, I kind of anticipated that Jordan would win the title back just because of what I had seen from Benoit in the previous year. I thought, oh, they're going to use Benoit to build up Jordan, and then Benoit got this, you know, quote unquote fluke victory. So every rematch, I would go, okay, this is where Jordan cheats and wins the belt back, and he just kills him again. Mm-hmm. It was hilarious.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. And then, obviously. Now, on a side note, since we are talking about Benoit, I don't want to belabor this point because I don't want to make Graham cry. But I don't think it was really till maybe the end of 06 that Benoit started to get that look that would obviously lead to what would happen that June of 07.
He had a look?
Yeah, you can even tell. He looked a little... Like, 05, I thought he looked fine. But for some reason, Justin and I talked about this before. And I've talked about this with other people. Like, the end of 06 is when he started looking kind of glazed. Like, his eye, like he kind of had that glazed over look. And it would kind of lead into 07, even when he was building up MVP. He kind of had that not all there all the time look. I never thought it would lead to anything, but... It always felt like that something clicked or something went in his head.
Well, if you thought it would lead to something, I hope that's on your conscience now.
Well, not that. What was I going to do, drive through? No! trivia for you, Graham, by the way. Speaking of his lovely wife, Nancy, God rest her soul. You would know this. I bet you Dan doesn't, but I'm going to test him anyway. I know you know the answer, Graham.
Well, that's not very nice.
What?
I bet Dan doesn't.
Well, I bet he doesn't. And I know you, Dan. All right, Dan.
I'm used to Justin burying me on the air.
I'll let you host a main event if you get this right.
Oh, God.
Let. Force.
When woman was a babyface in mid-'89, when she was kind of hanging out with Missy Hyatt, what was her name?
Who's answering?
Dan is, because I know you know.
Okay.
Gosh, you got me there, Scott. I don't know the answer.
I wanted to give you a fair shot. Go ahead, Graham.
Robin Green.
Robin Green. And then she tripped.
God, what is wrong with me? No one should know that.
I just know that because I watched it. Well, at Clash of the Champions 8, she tripped the Steiner. She tripped Scott Steiner in a where they were in a tag title match against the Freebirds. And it was her. And then at Halloween Havoc, she was managing Doom, who made their debut against Steiners. Yeah. So.
I'm like Rain Man over here.
Jimmy Garvin, worst Freebird ever, but that's a totally other different, totally different show.
That's such a weird dichotomy because I feel bad for not knowing the answer, and Graham feels bad for actually knowing
the answer. All right, before I
sometimes I just pretend that I'm more stupid than I am, so I don't look like a total nerd.
All right, before we turn this into a faux episode of Where the Big Boys Play, let's we'll get back here. All right, the next match is actually another... I tell you something, every feud on this show had some kind of real long, exciting, drawn-out situation. This next match, obviously, is where art imitated life. Now, we talked about Edge earlier on. His heel turn cemented in the fall of 04 when he was getting vociferously booed in his hometown of Toronto at SummerSlam in 2004. In that three-way with Jericho and Batista. Why do you think he got booed? I'll ask you, Dan. Why do you think Edge got booed in his home? I mean, there's no right or wrong answer. I was always curious what people's thoughts are on that. Why would he get booed in his hometown? Because, you know, popular guy, like you mentioned, one of your favorites. Mm. Why would he get booed in his hometown? I always thought that was odd.
I'll tell you what, I wasn't booing him, but then again, I also wasn't in Toronto. I'm not sure. I think people... They like what they see, and of course it's kind of a what have you done for me lately type of business, and not having him around for a little bit and fans starting to like and appreciate other talents, you know, it's like, oh great, Edge is back, you know. I don't know, it's kind of an odd thing. He talks about it a little bit on his newer DVD. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it really always did baffle me a bit. It's still the same great guy, still the guy that you were cheering before, but right. It just a bit of an attitude change, maybe from the time apart. It's kind of the opposite of absence making the heart grow fonder in this situation.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, if you remember historically, that's probably one of the weirdest bizarro crowds in WWE pay-per-view history, that Air Canada Center crowd that night. I remember they were doing the wave during matches. They were like, I think they were drunk on Labatt's or something. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that, Graham? Why do you think that crowd, do you think that the company in general was thinking Edge should be a heel? Was that already, do you think that was already in the plans, or did that crowd kind of make it more organic?
Well, I think the crowd certainly did, but I think the crowd knew that Orton was going to win, so they just kind of crapped out on the show.
That's entirely possible.
Because everyone loves Benoit.
Yeah, that was true.
No, I'm sorry. I'm just throwing that back in there.
Yeah. No,
I think it was the crowd, and really thinking about it, the only other guy where that happens to now is Cena.
Yeah.
Boston does not like him. I think Edge probably, in coming back in 04, he was starving for character development. Mm-hmm. He was the same guy from 2001, 2002, and 2003, and he takes a year off, and he's just kind of the same guy. And so I think at Vengeance with Orton, Edge wins, but Orton comes out the star of that match.
Right.
And then I think people kind of just saw it as, well, you're not as good as you used to be. Because there's these new guys coming along with, like, Randy Orton. So you have a belt, but, you know, whatever.
That's a good point. I like that theory. I like that theory. I think it was maybe just change of pace. But I also think, yeah, you were in a Canada, and knowing that their guy was going to lose, they might have just kind of shat all over the show. And I think they were anticipating a crappy JBL Undertaker match, too. So in any event, So Edge... And then they had that, what the hell was the name of the match at No Mercy? Last Rites? No.
Yeah, Last. I think that was it.
Was that what it was called? Last Rites? The hearse? Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what it was. Anyway, so Edge ends 04, and then 05, he wins the, he solidifies his heel turn, wins the inaugural Money in the Bank ladder match at WrestleMania 21, holds a briefcase all year. Meanwhile, rumors start circulating that Lita has been a little unfaithful. She has, you know, strayed from the homestead of her and Matt Hardy, dating back to, what, 1999, and stooped Edge on the road. And, of course, Matt Hardy pissed and moaned about it. He's the one who ended up getting fired. I remember that July, before any of this was this match was scheduled, he was supposed to be at a Ring of Honor show here in Connecticut. He was facing Christopher Daniels, and we thought he was going to get a huge pop. But right before that card, it was announced he had re-signed with WWE, and he got booed like crazy. The place was pro Daniels. I think Daniels won the match, actually. That was when I first enjoyed CM Punk. It was the first time I ever saw CM Punk live. He was the Ring of Honor. That was the Summer of Punk, and he fought James Gibson, of course, Jamie Noble. So he came back. He does the whole jumping through the crowd and all that jazz, and that leads us to this match between Edge and Matt Hardy, which ends after just under 5 minutes because Edge is just beating the shit out of him, or he gets hurt and he gets busted open or whatever, and the ref ends the match, which is an easy way for Edge to win without Matt having to get pinned or tap out. And, of course, Matt won the big match at Unforgiven in the cage, which is one of my favorite cage matches of all time. It was a great match. Surprised by that ending, Dan? Were you expecting Edge to win cheap, a count out? Did that ending, the whole referee stoppage, did that kind of throw you?
Oh, gosh, yes, it did. I mean, he took a really nasty spill right on top of the ring post, and then he was, bleeding profusely. I love the description of, like, with every heartbeat, he's, more blood. Right. I just love that analogy. But it was sort of a letdown for me, because I was still under the mindset of, it's SummerSlam. Something big's going to happen. I still wasn't buying into necessarily, even though it's been around for a little bit, the brand extension and the brand exclusive pay-per-views. I was like, if you're going to do something, it's going to happen at SummerSlam. And for this match to end so quickly, and with a referee stoppage, and with Matt basically just getting, absolutely pummeled, and there was some stiff-looking kicks to the dome he was taking in this match, and then all of a sudden the bell rings, and I was like, what? You build up this thing and I want Matt Hardy to, I liked Edge, but I wanted Matt Hardy to kick his ass. Like, I was like, I wanted blood, but not that way, And obviously it was to lead to bigger things, but at the time, just looking back in a bubble, I was like, no way. So not only does Edge get the girl, the hot chick, and he has someone to go home to and whatnot, now Matt is covered in blood and can't even fight and finish the fight on his own terms. Oh, how embarrassing. How tough.
Mm. Do you think Matt got hosed in this whole thing, Graham?
I don't know about hosed, because, he did win the big steel cage match a month later. Mm-hmm. I do agree that it was kind of a letdown for what it was, because, all the other feuds on the show were manufactured by the company, and this one's legit. And they pretty much tell you that this is legit, and it was white hot heat going into the show. It was the most emotionally investing feud on the card, and they send it out second, and they give it 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in my mind, it could have almost main evented under a title match or under Hogan Michaels and gone 15 and, go into the crowd and go outside and pretty much treat it as a false count anywhere kind of thing for what it was. And it was just one of those rare occasions. It was almost like a Bret Shawn in 97.
Mm-hmm.
They hate each other. They're going to throw some stiff punches and kicks, and you want to see it. And they really didn't give it to you.
Right. So, all right. Well, Obviously, that feud would move on for a couple more months, and eventually Matt Hardy would lose the Edge would win the feud because he'd end up losing to Matt Hardy on Raw, which would get Matt kicked off Raw, and he'd end up going to SmackDown, where he'd have a bit of a renaissance over the next few years, actually. So I think it was better a career move for him. Well, we're going to take a break. We got a boatload left of the card to go. I took a lot of time kind of backstorying the era before we got into the card, but we'll hustle through some of the lesser-known matches. But there's a lot of good ones coming up next, both title matches. Graham's favorite match involving Kurt Angle's gold medal. That was one match he was really looking forward to on this card. And a lot more. So this is the Place to Be Network's special SummerSlam Rewind Series 2005. More after the break.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today. Plus, we'll be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, placetobenation.com.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling. We talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right, the Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials run and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Greetings, friends. Ben Morse from Place to Be Nation's Main Event here. Tired of other podcasts constantly stuck in the past? Every other week, we give you a roundtable discussion of what's happening in wrestling today. Place to Be Nation's Main Event. We're holding everybody else down.
Looking for something different in your pro wrestling podcast? Look no further than the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Join me, Stephen Graham, every week as I'm joined by a rotating door of guests as we discuss a single topic each show, ranging from ECW pay-per-view reviews, wrestler snapshots, top six lists, and anything else you can think of. That's the Pro Wrestling Super Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, this sounds terrible. The Titans of Wrestling. Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans of Wrestling are...
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for show and breakdown matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Pav. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week you can join Marcus Vandenberg, Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on placetobenation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, sports fans, this is Dr. G for Extra Point, Place to Be Nation's traditional sports talk podcast. Every episode, Scott Criscullo and I talk everything from the big four leagues to all the hot sports news with exclusive guests and analysts. Email us your comments and questions at extrapoint@placetobenation.com. That's the Extra Point, exclusively on placetobenation.com.
Hey, sports fans, Cowboy here. Make sure you make your weekly stop by the Sports Lounge here on placetobenation.com, where the boys and I tackle all the hot topics in the world of sports. We go behind the numbers and provide in-depth expert analysis on Major League Baseball, MMA, NFL, and more. The seats fill up quick, so grab your favorite cigar, kick back, and join us in the Sports Lounge, only on placetobenation.com.
In Rhode Island, and look for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers, and a fully stocked bar. Bonehead's has something for everyone. Boneheads also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast, exclusively at placetobenation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
On Richard and the Mailman, we talk about life with great enthusiasm, which eventually leads to disillusionment and inevitably, hopelessness. But don't worry, there's lots of laughs along the way. So check us out every week or month or whatever on Richer and the Mailman.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at placetobenation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and piledriverwrestling.net. Welcome back, Place to Be Nation, to this special presentation on the Place to Be Podcast Network, our SummerSlam Rewind series. I'm Scott Criscolo, along with Graham Cawthon and Dan McGinn. We're talking SummerSlam 2005, and we're a couple matches in. Let's talk about the next match, which is another feud that dates back to, well, I guess dates back to February, when they were both on the same side. If you remember, obviously these two guys, Rey Mysterio and Eddie Guerrero, are like two peas in a pod. They go back to AAA, right? Is that where they wrestled in Mexico? AAA, and they obviously wrestled. They didn't wrestle together in ECW. They were there at the same time, but Rey was feuding with Psychosis, and of course Eddie and Dean had those awesome TV title matches in 1995. But then they both got to WCW, they eventually hooked up, and that led to a great feud in 97, of course showcased by one of the greatest matches in WCW history, and that was Eddie and Rey at Halloween Havoc 97 for the Cruiserweight title, when Rey had his memorable all-purple outfit on. And then at the beginning of 05, they kind of hooked up together again, and then at No Way Out, they beat who for the blue belts? Dan, do you remember? Think 2005. Do you remember?
It's not Robin Green.
It's not Robin Green. This one should be a little easier. Do you remember? Who did JBL?
JBL. It's not JBL.
It's not JBL, but
the Basham Brothers.
The Basham
right?
Brothers. Yeah. Doug and Danny. Yes. Eddie and Rey beat the Bashams at No Way Out 05 to win the tag straps. But then they kind of had this budding rivalry. They wanted to see how they could face against each other. And then, of course, they met in the opener at WrestleMania 21 and had a fantastic match, and Rey won. And then Eddie got fed up, and then in one of the most awesome heel turns I think ever, Eddie just snaps on an episode of SmackDown, and he three amigos Rey on the steel steps, which was pretty sweet, I'm not going to lie. And I think Eddie is a heel when they slowed down his theme song. They made it really smarmy with the cell phone noise at the beginning. It was awesome. But then we get to the part of the storyline that I was never a big fan of, and that's the whole Dominic bedtime story thing. Graham, I would have been happy if the two of them just had a great feud and fought here in something instead of having to throw this whole kid thing. What were your thoughts on that? Did you think it was even needed, or you think it was a colossal waste?
I remember watching these episodes of SmackDown over at a friend's house, and as soon as Eddie started showing interest in Dominic, I would laugh hysterically. and I would go, oh my God, Eddie's going to claim that he's his dad before it even got to that point. And it was one of those things where so many of the quote-unquote IWC, you know, hated that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was so over the top that it was hilarious. Where Eddie is cutting a promo at the playground. Hilarious. And I think at the time, I think I would appreciate it just as much now too. It is so not what we saw from them in WCW. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, let's take what they had in WCW and then just completely WWE it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is. I will tell you, when I was driving earlier, and I was thinking, what am I going to talk about with SummerSlam 5? Because it's not one of my favorite shows. But I remember this is perhaps my favorite promo of all time leading up to the show is between Eddie and Ray. And it's where Eddie comes out. And if you've seen their two-pack action figure from 05, it's what Eddie's figure is referencing. Eddie comes out by himself. I think it's a week or so after he kills Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes out with Ray's mask. And he's in the ring for, 10, 15 minutes, whatever it is. It could have been 7 minutes. But it's so phenomenal because he does not say one word.
Right.
And yet he completely conveys what he's thinking, what he thinks of Ray, what he thinks of the fans. And he has the mic, and he doesn't say one word.
Mm-hmm.
And it was gold. I don't know if there's anyone now, and I'm not putting down the roster, but I don't know if there's anyone now that could convey to the extent that he did what happened in that segment.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely loved it. And I think those guys have great chemistry. And I thought this whole storyline, this whole gimmick was just so over the top hilarious. I was not offended by it.
Right.
I just thought it was hilarious. Mm-hmm. And it was not something where I legit thought that Eddie would win at the end of it and steal Dominic or anything like that. I just thought it was funny.
Yeah. I thought so too. Yeah. And then, the caseworker. Because I think to myself, yes, the best way to solve a custody dispute is put the contract over a ring and let two guys beat the crap out of each other for it.
And I think that's what Vicky said, I think, on one of these countdown shows or something on the network where they talk about the match, and mm-hmm. she kind of laughs at it the same way.
Yeah. It's just so ridiculous. The match itself was good. I liked it. And, of course, Ray wins. Eddie finally goes up. Thanks to Vicky. Eddie was about to grab it, and it's Vicky that pushes the ladder over, and then Ray grabs it, and happily ever after. Thank God. Sadly, of course, Eddie would look pretty good for the next couple months. He would transfer into a feud with World Heavyweight Champion Batista. They'd have a pretty good match at No Mercy. And then, of course, right before Survivor Series, he would sadly pass away. Dan, were you an Eddie guy?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I, going back to the Rumble, one of my favorite moments around this time period was when, he draws the number and he doesn't like his number, and Ric Flair's there and he draws his number, and then they hug, and then next thing you know, he steals the number of Ric Flair. Like, I'm just like, wow, that was Eddie. They were able to like capture his essence of him lying, cheating, stealing.
Right.
And I'm sure I'm sure when he wasn't obviously battling his own personal demons, he was a legit fun, nice guy to be around. And, you had to be on your toes with Eddie. And that was when he was still kind of a good guy face, mm-hmm. before he got all sinister here. Looking back at this match in particular, I just remember how there were some great spots, the senton above the ladder, basically Eddie goes smack down onto the floor. There was the spot where Ray does the back body drop and Eddie crashes down on the ladder, but because his momentum, slammed down the ladder, then Ray falls in a very ungraceful manner, and it just really added some realness to the match. Like, okay, yeah, you can have some really good, well-orchestrated spots, but this actually made this look more like a blood feud. Like, hey, man, we're in a fight. It doesn't. It's not going to look pretty. And so you look at it and you're like, wow, that looked kind of like a botch. But no, that's what added more to the intensity of the match itself. But mm-hmm. to get back to what you were saying about Eddie, it was quite a metamorphosis from all that happy-go-lucky lying, cheating, and stealing, and all of a sudden it's like, listen, this is my son. Your boy is not yours. It's like really sinister. It's really quite a contrast from what we were used to before.
Yeah, I think that's what made Eddie as great as he was. Did you ever meet Eddie, Graham? Did you ever
no,
meet him in your travails? No.
I mean, the closest I got at 20 when he drives out and he walks around the car, I'm like right there.
Oh, okay.
So that was the closest I got.
Okay. Yeah, very sad. And I have the Viva La Raza set. And if you, for those listening that don't have it, get it. It's pretty awesome. So, it also has his last match ever, which was a Survivor Series qualifying match. Another trivia question. I'll give this one to you, Graham. Who was Eddie's last actual match against?
Kennedy.
And you wonder why I don't ask you. Would you have known that, Dan?
Sad. I have that DVD, and I don't remember. I didn't remember. So
it's an extra. It's actually not. It's not in the regular line of progression. Mm-hmm. It's in the extras. You have to look for it. It's on disc three. So yeah, it was Mr. Kennedy. It was a Survivor Series qualifying match for that Raw versus SmackDown or whatever they were doing, and then he died, I think, that Sunday. So, all right. Next is now. This is one of your favorite characters, Graham, and easily not one of my favorites. Because I thought this guy got kicked really far down the card after what a great first half of 2005 he had, and that's Kurt Angle. Kurt lost to Cena at No Way Out, the number one contenders match, but then puts on an absolute sparkling gem that no one was surprised about at WrestleMania against Shawn Michaels. I mean, who was going to expect either of those guys was going to put on anything less than perfect? I actually, believe it or not, though, I like their Vengeance match better. Dan, do you remember both those matches? Do you remember them well? Which one did you think was better?
You know, I really liked the Mania match, and if you asked me this probably a few months ago, I probably would have said Mania hands down. But then in watching the second battle and then kind of getting more of the story behind it, and it was just, I mean, the spot at the end with the super kick when Kurt was just like, how do I beat this guy? Well, I don't go to the top rope. It was just like, it was such a phenomenal match. It was good. I like conclusions. Like, now that if you watch the WrestleMania match by itself, mm-hmm. yeah, it's a great match. But the fact that the other match was, you know, basically an end of a very good story.
Right.
Just a terrific, terrific battle. And I agree what you're saying about Booker. I mean, it's so weird how guys in this particular year just sort of bounce around. You have those couple great matches with Shawn Michaels. Then you have a rather weird, you know, thing involving Booker T and his wife, and
that's right, the animal sex. That's right.
I want to have sex with your wife, Booker. You know, it's like
I want to have animal sex with her.
Yeah, where did that come from?
I forgot about that.
You know, we all learned what gutter slut was.
Gutter slut.
And I'm like, is this the same guy who had that epic match against Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania? And now we get this match, which, like, again, the very definition of what the hell. Coming up at this one.
Isn't that what you were calling D'Amato Saturday night? Weren't you calling him a gutter slut?
I think I was.
He might have been calling everybody else a gutter slut. Anyway. And then he, as I mentioned, he had this fantastic match at Vengeance with Sean, which I think my personal opinion is better. Which one do you like better, Graham?
Oh, I like Vengeance, and I like Vengeance more than Mania, the overall show.
Yeah, I do too. I love Vengeance.
I love Vengeance.
Yeah, Vengeance 05 might be one of my like five favorite pay-per-views ever. That probably because that, I mean, not only, of course, because that Hell in a Cell is one of my like two or three favorite Cell matches of all time, too. So here's Kurt now with this silly gold medal thing. And then here's Eugene, who I think this gimmick should have died like 7 months earlier, wins the gold medal in the challenge. And then Kurt pretty much dismantles him in 4.5 minutes here and takes it back. Waste of Kurt Angle, Graham? Here?
I don't know about a waste, but, you know, on paper, knowing what Eugene can do as an actual wrestler,
mm-hmm.
it's a pretty intriguing match. Seriously, because Dinsmore can work.
Yeah, he can.
And Angle can work. And so you're almost thinking, this could be kind of like a sleeper.
Mm-hmm.
And then goes like 5 minutes.
I think that maybe that was more disappointing. I mean, Dinsmore, when he was in OVW, was pretty solid. He worked pretty well down there. Then, of course, they rehired him back after he got fired for being drunk or high in London or whatever the hell. He fell asleep in a phone booth or whatever the hell happened.
Well, I mean, you see how this show goes, and obviously coming from it, you go, okay, well, they were building Angle, they were giving Angle some more credibility because he's about to go into a title program with Cena.
Right.
I think you needed more than that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I agree with that. What do you think, Dan? Do you think was Angle wasted here, or was this a good spot and just the match should have been more?
Considering the fact that Eugene, I mean, he had a tag title earlier in the year,
right,
hurt his knee, and then it really kind of stunted things. He had a cameo at WrestleMania. When I think of some of the other guys that weren't on this card, I think to myself, really, did we need to have this necessarily? I do, though, rewatching this, do chuckle a little bit at the actual match itself. It's like, well, as long as we're doing it, we might as well, you know, have some fun with this. I mean, Eugene hits the stunner, which was kind of a cool spot, and Angle sold it like it was actually Stone Cold who did it. Like, he looked like he was dead after taking that stunner.
Mm-hmm.
There's one spot that I noticed that I made a note of. At one point, like, I mean, Angle was such a bastard at this point. Like, he like, had him, like, locked down, and he couldn't move, and then you could just see, like, him just spitting on him. It was just, like, phenomenal. It's like, God, it's bad enough this guy is supposedly playing up this learning impaired, you know, individual, but now you're, like, spitting on him and jaw-jacking with him when you have complete dominance over the guy.
Right.
And then, of course, you know, my favorite part that actually made me chuckle was when he gets the chair, he puts it in the middle of the ring after winning the match, and he gets up on the chair, and then he has the referee put the gold medal around his neck,
yes,
a la 1996. I was like, oh my God, that's awesome.
I forgot about that. That is pretty awesome. I did forget about that. So Kurt Angle wins this match fairly easily in about 4.5 minutes, and as Graham mentions, moves on in another actually the next night to a program with John Cena, which I think is the feud that turned John Cena into what he is now, which is a polarizing figure. And we'll talk more about that when we get to Cena. All right, the next match, again, another feud that was born at WrestleMania. Randy Orton, who was kind of floating aimlessly after losing at the Rumble in that weird concussion storyline thing to Triple H for the World Heavyweight title, returns heel after the, you know, tested six-month babyface run, and now takes on The Undertaker, who is a year back from his hiatus and, you know, return as the Dead Man after the American Badass phase. And they were doing the whole Legend Killer thing, and he stunned Moolah. He stunned, RKO'd. Same, almost the same move. Diamond Cut, I suppose it would be, I guess. But he RKO'd Moolah. He RKO'd Jake Roberts on a Raw. I think it was in Atlanta, if I remember correctly. Right, Graham? That Raw, where he RKO's Jake. Wasn't that Atlanta?
During the highlight reel or something?
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe.
I have a feeling because it was Jake, I have a feeling it was Atlanta. Anyway, and that leads to this to the match at WrestleMania, which, of course, Taker wins. But there were some rumblings that this was where the streak was going to end. Did you hear any strong scuttlebutt about that, Graham?
At 21?
That Orton was supposed to win? Or that this might have been the match where Orton wins?
I don't remember, but, you know, like I said, you know, tail end of 04, I'm thinking they have really big plans for him.
Mm-hmm.
So it would not have shocked me.
Okay. So, but it doesn't happen anyway. Taker wins. They continue on. And then Orton, and for the, and I can remember the last time this happened. We have a few of these. Well, we have one anyway, where we have a calendar year where WrestleMania and SummerSlam have the same match. Can't really remember the last time that happened. And Randy Orton and The Undertaker work here. I thought this match was a little long. I don't think we needed to see 17 minutes of this match. I think this match could have been perfectly fine in, like, 10. Orton wins. And this feud even continues further. And, of course, it's capped off at Armageddon, a show I was at. Me and Mr. Rosero were at the Prominent Civic Center, which Orton loses to Taker in Hell in a Cell, infamously called the hepatitis match because of Bob Orton. Did this feud go too long, Graham, do you think? Did this need to go all the way to Armageddon? Should it have ended here? Should they have had a match in between and then Taker ended here? Was it fine going to December? What were your thoughts on this feud overall?
Well, Mania, I think going into that, he's not... I don't know if he's necessarily a heel. I mean, he's heel by default.
Right.
But he was, you know, such a heavily promoted babyface going into it. And then this match, following the summer, where he beats Taker, but he beats him by cheating, and really solidifies that heel spot. So no, I think the pacing was fine. I think by the fall, where you've got Survivor Series, and then you've got Orton saying Eddie's in hell or whatever, and driving the car. I don't know. It fell apart. I think it kind of became maybe a little offensive during that time too, to some people.
Right.
And then by the time of Hell in the Cell, you're just whatever. Let's okay.
End it.
Don't care.
Yeah. What'd you think, Dan? Did you think this feud went too far? Too long, not too far, too long.
Yeah, and I don't think this is the only time it happened for SummerSlam, but I feel like they dug this back up, so to speak, only because of the draft lottery. And it's like, okay, well, we're on a new show, but hey, why don't we bring that feud back? Because now we're on the same show again. All right, sounds good. You know, like that's how I kind of got the impression, because you look at it after the whole Evolution thing, and after, you know, once Batista basically got the gold, and Orton kind of became forgotten. And in fact, there were some pay-per-views where I was like, man, Randy Orton's not on this pay-per-view. That's incredible. And then all of a sudden, oh, hey, now he's fighting Taker. So it's wild how a guy who was on so much could then be so invisible for a time during this year. Mm-hmm. And it was like, well, what are we going to do with Taker? I don't know. What about Orton? Oh, well, why don't we put them together? Because, you know, the draft kind of made it so, you know, I think we will see that later on as well. That you know, we got to do something with these guys, and who better to work with a young up and comer who we see bright things for than a guy like Taker, who's been around forever. I think it was at booking wise, I don't think it was a bad idea. But you look at it with these kind of pay per views, it's like, well, we have SmackDown this month, and we got Raw next month. Things went probably a little bit longer than they had to be, just because of the brand extension.
Yeah. Well, was Orton hurt during the spring?
I didn't think so.
Because the way I kind of got the feud at this point was Orton wanted the streak, he lost, and then whether he just took time off or whether he was hurt or whatever, he's off kind of, you know, brewing and just like, oh, I'm going to get him back and whatever. And then Taker tries to... Who is he facing? Oh, was he facing JBL for the title shot at SummerSlam?
Yes.
Okay, because Taker beats Muhammad Hassan and
at
kills him. Right. And then he faces JBL the next night for the title shot, and that's when Orton comes back, and that's when Orton costs Taker the match.
So he must have been hurt. Or maybe he just went on hiatus. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So but I thought that whole, you know, Mania to SummerSlam story, and then having Bob Orton there and them working together to cost Taker the match, I thought that was captivating.
Yeah.
Now what happens after that, it kind of loses me.
Yeah, well, then Taker goes on hiatus, because they have the, after this match, which Orton wins, then they have a casket match at No Mercy, which Orton wins again, and then they set the casket on fire.
That's never been done before.
Yeah, really. And then they're on hiatus. Taker takes a little time off, and he comes back at Survivor Series, because Orton's the last one standing in that match. And then Taker comes out at the end, and then, of course, that ends with the cell at Armageddon. But my only thing about this match was I don't think it really needed to be 17 minutes. I think that's a bit of a stretch.
Can I just say one thing? I have never, and I saw this recently on a WCW pay-per-view from like 98. I think it was Halloween Havoc or something, in which they do this angle where like, oh my gosh, it's a fan in the ring. You know, I always feel very queasy and uncomfortable about the, you know, oh, let's throw a fan, let's throw a quote fan into the ring.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, this is real, folks. This isn't part of the act. And then obviously in this situation, it was part of the act. I get it. But I hate that booking style. And,
right.
And then when they panned in closer, it's like, oh, that's not real at all. But at the time, it's like, what's this crazy man doing in the ring? I just have never been a big fan of using that as a means to end a match quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Dano, do me a favor. While I'm starting up the next match, can you look up for me how long their match at WrestleMania was?
Surely.
Between the two. I'm curious to see if it was shorter or longer than this one. This one was 17-17, which I thought was kind of long. All right, next up, our first big title match of the evening, and that is a guy we've talked about a lot tonight, John Cena, who won the title at WrestleMania, and then an awesome match at Judgment Day, the I Quit with JBL. I think that show was in Nashville. Might be wrong. Maybe it's Memphis. Something like that. And
Minneapolis.
In Minneapolis. Thank you.
I think so.
And I'm usually good with cities. It was bloody and it was a great match. Then he takes on Jericho after he comes to Raw, and Cena was still really over. Like, he had his fan base very solid. In my opinion, it wasn't until his next feud that the split happens. So, okay. And Dan, you have confirmed with me that the match at Mania was a couple minutes shorter, which I find very interesting, that the match at WrestleMania was actually longer. When we had two 20-minute matches already and a 15-minute match. So that puzzles me why that one had to be as long, too. Yeah, Cena, the fans at this point had not turned on Cena yet. Chris Jericho is not, sadly, and I think it's actually indicative now, even in this feud modern day with Bray Wyatt. Jericho is not in that class of Edge, Kurt, Shawn, like that group that is very polarizing and that everybody loves. I don't necessarily think, even at this point, 05, that everybody loves Chris Jericho, which is why I think Cena was firmly the babyface here, and there was no, like, you know, smatterings of cheers when Jericho faced him here. I don't think that happens again till the diehard wrestler, you know, diehard work rate fans turned on Cena because they were feuding with his guy, their guy, which was Kurt. That's what I always think. I think the Kurt feud in 05 is what began the love-hate of John Cena. This match is not bad. It's about 15 minutes. But I think it was another legitimizing for Cena because he was moved to Raw. Did you think, Graham, when Cena and Batista pretty much flip-flop that Cena was made the more showcase guy because of it, and that made this match just as important?
I saw Cena as the guy before the flip-flop, but yeah, obviously, if you're the guy on Raw instead of the guy on SmackDown, you are the one with the company firmly behind you.
Incidentally, a glaring omission on this show, a guy that is not on this show, and he wasn't even really hurt, that, of course, being... Mariah Carey, that of course being Triple H, who lost to Batista at Vengeance and then left, and he didn't come back until October.
The Homecoming.
Yeah, the Homecoming show in October. He took like 5 months off.
Batista killed him.
You're just not good enough to beat me. They do the whole handshake thing after Vengeance where Triple H has all the dry blood on his face and Batista's wearing just nothing but a towel, which most of the divas were probably the only time you usually saw him. Triple H is gone, didn't come back till October 3rd, I think it was. And then he had that awesome feud with Ric Flair. Dan, was this an important match for Cena to look good in?
I think so. It's wild because he has the feud with JBL, then gets drafted. And it's funny because they had hinted at a feud with Christian as far back as the Rumble, And Christian even came out on a pay-per-view he wasn't wrestling on and cuts a promo on all the main eventers. And it looked as though Christian was the guy that was going to be the guy to challenge Cena. Not necessarily to beat him, but to have, you need somebody to challenge, you know, now that you've reached the top of the mountain, you need somebody that's chasing you. Mm-hmm. And I honestly thought, and it was a triple threat pay-per-view main event this year in which Christian was on there, and Jericho was basically the guy that introduced Cena to the Raw audience. So it makes sense that you had a veteran guy like Jericho in there. He said in his book, he always believed in a guy like Cena to be a top guy,
right,
and really wanted to work him. And I think it was a perfect opponent. Although I, as a big fan of Christian back in the day too, I thought, man, I mean, that was such a great feud. But then they bounced Christian to SmackDown. That was kind of the norm for this time period. But yeah, I think this was important because, you know, Cena, let's face it, he had those feuds with JBL. Jericho's a much different performer than JBL was. This is his first real showcase on the franchise show, the big show. And yeah, he didn't go on last. Yeah, there's another title on this card, another big title on this card. But I just think that these guys really wanted to put on a show, and Jericho was a big believer in Cena, and they didn't have as much time as many title matches get, mm-hmm. but I think they made the most of that opportunity.
Yeah, I think so too. And then Cena, of course, wins the next night in a You're Fired match, and then Jericho goes off and does Fozzy, and he doesn't come back for, Jesus, almost a year and a half. Actually, longer than that. 2 years. Almost 2 years. Because he doesn't come back till, what, November of 07. So there you go. John Cena retains his WWE title, and the next night starts the feud with Kurt Angle. And in my opinion, that's where the polarizing happened, because Kurt Angle was a guy that the diehard guys loved because it's Kurt. And I think that's where the split in the fan base of John Cena began and has stayed that way to this day. So next up, the other big title match, and this is almost like the trade-off, like, well, you know what, Batista, you got the better match at WrestleMania, so you're stuck with this for SummerSlam. And that is Batista and John Bradshaw Layfield JBL, who, of course, you know, obviously he is the main event heel on the show, so when the belts swapped, JBL obviously was slated in that spot. I think from the beginning everybody knew that this was a bad idea. And, of course, they had a regular singles match at the Bash, and that was like watching grass grow. I mean, just absolutely dreadful. This one, even no holds barred, this one's really no better. I remember going to a Raw at Mohegan Sun that summer. My brother and I went because he loved Sean, and he wanted to kick Hogan's ass, and we'll get to that match last. But remember, guys, they used to have those like main event dark matches that they used to pimp. And the main event dark match was these two, was Batista and JBL in a no holds barred. Same match that they had here. Absolutely sucked bad. And I was nowhere looking forward to this match. Graham, do you blame these guys? Do you think it's these guys individually? Like, you know, Batista and JBL have only so much of a work rate. I mean, they're power brawlers. Everybody knows what kind of... How do I word it? Were you expecting anything out of this match? Were your expectations low? Did you go into it saying, all right, well, we'll see what they'll do the best they can? Or were you expecting something better?
I didn't expect much, and I got it.
Yeah. There's really nothing else to say, you know?
Right, right. What put Batista on the map was working with Triple H, who, whether you like him or not, can do just about anything and do it pretty well. And so he can make Batista look like $1 million. And JBL, I think, works better with smaller guys. Batista's not a smaller guy. It was just a completely different dynamic, and it did not work.
Yeah, I agree with you about the smaller guy. JBL's one of those guys that likes to knock around guys that are at least 30, 40 pounds lighter than him.
He's a bully.
Yeah.
You can't bully a guy that's bigger than you.
Yeah, in a better shape than you, too.
Right.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that, Dan?
I thought there was a chance that this could be okay. If you go back to No Way Out, there was still kind of that intrigue of whether or not Batista would turn on Triple H and whether or not he should just go after JBL and then he could dominate SmackDown. And they even got the cabinet involved and him, like, you know, ripping the horns off of the limo and stuff. So I thought there was a chance that maybe, you know, we could see these two just beat the crap out of each other and it'd be really enjoyable. And then, of course, it didn't happen. And now, because of the lottery and the changeover, because, you know, he had that great little tournament that set up some feuds on SmackDown where JBL wins and he thinks he's the new, whatever they called it, the SmackDown champion. And then next thing you know, Teddy Long basically, hey, by the way, we don't need a SmackDown champion anymore. We have a champion. And out comes Batista. Like, I was a little bit excited about the prospect of this. And then you watch it and it's just like, all right, let's move on. And again, it's a match that's very unbecoming of, I mean, you almost forget that JBL was the champ for as long as he was, and to see him just get, you know, pistol whipped for 9 minutes and then it's over, you know. But I will say this, I think I enjoyed kind of like what we were talking about with JBL and Cena before. I kind of like the idea of this match more with the no holds barred and the more violence. It just made for a better, more enjoyable match, but this certainly wasn't a great match to watch and wouldn't be anything that you would want to throw in on, you know, when you're bored and just want to watch some wrestling. I thought there was potential because it was like a feud that was kind of under the radar earlier in the year, but definitely didn't deliver.
Yeah. And then, of course, Batista would kind of skate through the end of the year. He'd obviously the one match with Eddie, and then, of course, Eddie passes away, and Batista's kind of floating in limbo. He's wins a tag straps with Ray, and then he hurts his arm and he's gone for, you know, 7 months or whatever. JBL kind of coasts as well. Feuds end of 05. He feud with the Boogeyman, which is kind of talk about a demotion. And then he feuds with Ray in 06, and then he kind of vanishes and then bounces around for another couple years. All right. Now for the marquee match, the match that pretty much made this show, the Federation era Kingpin versus the New Generation Kingpin, and that is, of course, Hulk Hogan and Shawn Michaels. And, of course, obviously this was began technically when Hogan was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame that year. He was, of course, the centerpiece guy. I love that class because it was him and every heel he ever vanquished. My brother Kevin thought he should have got someone beat the shit out of him. I thought that would have been pretty cool myself, actually. Or like when Hogan walked out and all the guys were, you know, like they do every year at WrestleMania where they all come out and, you know, their tuxes on the stage. And my brother's like, because I remember it was like Orndorff, Sheik, what was it, Nikolai, Piper. It was like every heel that Hogan ever faced and vanquished. And they're all in the same class. They thought they should have like got up and just like pummeled the shit out of them. That would have been pretty funny. Shawn Michaels after WrestleMania, you know, he begs Hogan to help him against Muhammad Hassan, and then of course the infamous super kick heard around the world. I remember my brother was flipping out when that happened. Incidentally, guys, for those that may not know, my brother hates Hulk Hogan. I've said that probably a few times. Now, the big backstage or the rumor was that Shawn wanted this to be face versus face. Let's just have a great epic Hogan Warrior type match where, you know, let's just test each other's mettle and have a great match and see what happens. I don't think Shawn even cared if he won. I think he wanted, but Vince and them went to Shawn and said, nope, Hogan wants to be the babyface. He wants you to be the heel. He wants to be the only babyface. Figures. Typical Hogan. And apparently the writers tell Shawn, and he wants you to be like, he doesn't want you to be like 92 Shawn or just normal heel. He wants you to be Shawn. He wants you to be like the 97 Shawn. And I remember, and apparently, I forgot who told me this, but like Shawn pretty much said, are you sure? Because if you want me to be that Shawn, I'm not going to do kiddie jokes. I'm going to bury him and talk about his bald head, about he has no moves. I'm going to bury him. So if you want me to be that Shawn, you're going to get that Shawn. And I don't want to hear him pissing and moaning about it. It's pretty much the way that it seemed to have gone. So let me ask you this, Graham. Knowing the way the match went, and it was a pretty good match, wasn't Shawn's greatest, but then again, look what he had to work with. Could this match have been better if it was a simple face versus face? If it was booked differently, like Hogan Warrior at six in terms of that kind of psychology and that kind of fan energy. Would the match have been any different, or what you saw was what you got regardless?
Well, I think if it's face versus face, the crowd would crap on Hogan winning.
That's probably why he did it.
Well, yeah, it could be. And I'm not going to criticize him for that, because if he didn't act like Hulk Hogan, he wouldn't be Hulk Hogan.
Well, true.
And he wouldn't have done everything that he's done for him in the industry.
Right.
I think if it was face for face, you could not have taken the match seriously for Shawn bumping as comically as he did.
It was pretty funny.
It was a cartoon.
Yeah, it was.
And he was, you know, Wile E. Coyote.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't have worked with him being a face.
Hmm. What do you think, Dan?
I think they still wanted to have this image of Hulk Hogan being the returning hero, the whole one more match thing. I don't think they wanted to be in a situation. And Shawn still, even with the heel persona, got some cheers. I mean, it wasn't like people had forgotten how much they loved Shawn just because Hulk Hogan was in the ring. But I think that they wanted, and Hogan probably wanted to a certain extent, wanted to keep that thrill alive from the Hall of Fame. Like, oh, we miss you, Hulk. You're great. We love you. We love you. So the only way I think they were going to get that type of thing was if, you know, Shawn was a like, for lack of a better term, an asshole. Like, you know, they had to kind of make their a real definitive difference between our hero from the past versus, you know, like, oh, what's gotten into Shawn? Why would he do such a thing? You know, I agree, though, with the selling and stuff. It was rather comedic, you know, with him bouncing all up and down on the ropes and everything like that. But I think people still wanted to see, or the company really still wanted to see Hulk Hogan as the, you know, the cartoon character, the larger than life, the hero from our childhood. I think that they were really pushing the nostalgia there, I think.
And then, of course, the awesome Raw promo the next night where Shawn pretty much shits all over him. and then of course, he starts that feud with Chris Masters. I don't know if that was an upgrade in ability. I'm not sure. All right. I know you said personally, Graham, that this isn't one of your favorite WrestleManias. But historically, should this
be... Or SummerSlams.
I mean, SummerSlams. I'm sorry. SummerSlams. But historically, does this one not get the credibility that it probably should? Or do you think it's, you know, maybe it's just another show?
It was a big transition era. They had belts on guys that at that point had probably not created the credibility that they needed to be main event guys. They had Hogan and Shawn in a main event match that meant absolutely nothing the very next day.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a weird show. And they had Edge and Matt in the hottest match on the show that basically gets a no contest finish.
Right.
So I think it's a very mixed bag.
Mm. But specifically then, for the two guys we've kind of highlighted, Cena and Batista, was it a success or a failure for the two of them, considering this was their first major pay-per-view since being elevated to that main event status? Were they able to succeed in their goal?
It was fine, but if you think of Cena and Batista, you don't think of SummerSlam 05.
Okay. What do you think, Dan?
I think Cena looked good. I think they could at least feel a little bit confident. This guy was, you know, going to be a guy that people are going to enjoy seeing. Eventually, of course, things would turn a little bit, but he was a franchise. He was a cornerstone. I think with Batista, it wasn't the greatest showcase in the world. Maybe not the best opponent in the world, but it's really hard, as we talked about before, to go from an epic 3+ match battle with Triple H. And I love JBL, but he's not Triple H at the end of the day. So, yeah, did they still have their two stud champions? Sure. but it wasn't necessarily, I think, the showcase they wanted. I think Cena benefited from having a much better opponent and a lot more time to tell a better story.
Hmm. I think so, too. I think Batista had established himself. I think everybody knew that this was not going to be anything earth-shattering. But Cena, I think this was a big win for Cena because, like I said, I think things would get rocky for him in terms of fan support from here on out. He would struggle to keep his the big cheers when he feuded with Angle. And then Edge. Even the Triple H love was pretty hot going into WrestleMania 22. And then, you know, we can go on down the line. But I think this was a big thumbs up for Cena to win a big match on this big show. All right, Graham, you have we'll wrap this up. You said you have a SummerSlam story for us pertaining to
the
show. I
do, and this is actually what I remember most about the show, and it had really nothing to do with the show. Now next week is the NWA Legends Fan Fest in Charlotte,
yes. Yep.
Which I have not been to in a few years, but I'm looking forward to coming back this year. This same weekend in 2005, SummerSlam weekend, was FanFest weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the headliners, if not the headliner, was Bret Hart.
Ah, that's right. I remember that. Yeah.
And if you remember, I believe they did Raw in Montreal a few weeks before SummerSlam.
Yes.
And Sean, being 1997 Sean, uses Bret's theme music.
In his promo. And, yep.
Right, right.
Yep.
And the message boards and the internet was just all a buzz.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Because, you know, Bret and Vince are kind of friends now. Bret's got a DVD coming out. He went up there. They're doing a documentary on him. Is he going to show up? Because this is very much 1997 Sean.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of 1997 Sean, you think of 1997 Bret Hart.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was pretty much, you know, this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. Sunday afternoon, I mean, everyone's like, this is happening, to the point where, you know, you see that Bret's doing a Q&A at, you know, 2, and you're trying to do the math. Okay, so it's an hour-long Q&A, he can be at the airport 15 minutes after that, then he's got to fly to D.C. Yeah, I mean, this can happen, sure, it's the logistics work out. So, he's doing the Q&A. First question. Are you going to be at SummerSlam tonight? And he goes, no.
That's funny.
And then we're still thinking, oh, he's totally working us. He's totally going to be at SummerSlam. And so, the FanFest wraps up. It's Sunday afternoon, or Sunday night. And, most Sundays, by the afternoon, everyone's already going home.
Right.
This was the summer after I graduated college. I really didn't have to be in a rush to go home, so I stayed another night in the hotel. So myself and you know, four or five other guys, we're like, okay, it's Sunday. We got nothing to do. Let's go find a place to show in SummerSlam. You would think in Charlotte, North Carolina, you could find some kind of restaurant pretty easily, some kind of bar that's showing pay-per-view. We drove around so long that when we finally found a Hooters and we got out of the car, Hogan was coming out to the ring.
Jesus.
And the Hooters was so packed that we had to stand outside and watch on the screens from inside.
Oh, my God. Thankfully...
they had speakers outside, so you could hear the commentary.
Mm-hmm.
We only got to watch the main event. And this was one of the funniest wrestling experiences I've ever had, is as the crowd is emptying after the show, because after the show, they pretty much shut down the restaurant. Me and my friends are asking everyone, who won that match? Who won that match? Oh, but who won that match? And we went through the entire card so we would figure out who won what. And I remember when someone said, oh, yeah, Benoit won, I was like, yes, 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 I don't care about the rest of the show. And then we walked across the street and had IHOP at like 11 o'clock at night.
Nice.
And that is my favorite memory of SummerSlam 05, and it really didn't have a whole lot to do with the show.
I can't believe Charlotte, North Carolina, in Flair Country, there wasn't like one bar around.
Maybe we just were in the wrong place. A lot can change in 9 years.
True. That's funny. The IHOP was open, though. But
the IHOP was open.
But the Hooters was closing.
The Hooters was so packed, we could not sit down. We had to watch from outside.
Ole Anderson might have still been in the hotel. He could have told you where...
Ole would have no interest in watching SummerSlam. Ole would have no interest in watching StarrKid 85. He was not a fan of the Horsemen.
Wow. Really?
No. No. I've been around him through these events long enough to find out, you know, by the time the Horsemen came around, that was like the twilight of his career. He,
true.
Whatever. Mm. Pay me.
Hmm. That might be another topic for another show. I'm fascinated by that. Interesting.
Ole Anderson complaints?
No, Ole Anderson not liking the Horsemen. Ole Anderson complaints could last 2 years.
Yeah.
Ole Anderson from the hotel. I think that's its own High Spots DVD on the way. Well, guys, it has been an honor and a privilege to have you both here tonight to discuss, as part of our Place to Be Podcast Network's SummerSlam Rewind series, SummerSlam 2005. I know, Graham, you were longing to be at Wembley, but I thank you for being on tonight.
Whenever I build my DeLorean, that's where I'm going.
Your DeLorean's going to be riding next to Rocco on the long...
Yes.
On the long red Rocco. That always pissed me off to no end.
Didn't Graham also have to do, like, King of the Ring 95 once?
Yeah! Yeah, I did. What did I do to you?
I'm going to fucking kill you, Dan. I swear to God. This is why nobody likes you.
Nobody?
What's Rob Dimension's name, number again? No, I'm just kidding. All right, so you got to do WrestleMania 12. You got to do the Iron Man.
Even still. It wasn't 8.
No, it wasn't 8. Sorry. I didn't realize you were such a 1992 love. Well, maybe we'll do... well, you know what, Graham? I'll book you now, because we haven't done a Rumble Rewind series yet. Maybe we'll do Rumble 92.
I'll be there.
I'm booking you now. Justin can't take that one away from me. Rumble 92. Dan, because you have a big mouth, you're going to do Rumble, like, 87, okay? So, all right. For Dan McGinn and the great Graham Cawthon, I'm Scott Criscolo. Hope you enjoyed this here on the Place to Be Podcast Network. Enjoy SummerSlam 2014 from the Staples Center in Los Angeles. Enjoy.